This session is the third installment of a four-part Fall 2021 Risk E-Learning webinar series. If you missed the first two webinars, the recorded archives are now available on the CLU-IN website. I don't know if that's CLU-IN. I'm sorry, I don't know my acronyms in the NIEHS world. The final session will be this Friday, October 22nd, and will feature communication toolkits to communicate environmental risks. Please refer to the links that have just been copied in the live chat. The series builds on the Superfund Research Program workshop that was held in June that was focused on risk communication strategies to reduce exposures and improve health. I know many of you were probably a part of that, that series, and I joined that day too, and it was a really wonderful workshop. The webinars delve into many of the themes that came up at that workshop. We used feedback from that meeting to identify the topics that we're going to hear about today and that we heard about on the other sessions. For those of you who don't know me yet, you'll know that you may not know this, but those of you who know me know that risk communication is something that's very near and dear to my heart. And so I'm really grateful to be a part of this program today and hear this great information from researchers around the country. Risk communication is so critical to the work we do at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and better risk communication really will help us better meet the needs of the American public. That's my little personal spiel, but I want to turn back to the workshop that we're about to get underway. The workshop website will now have include links from the meeting report and workshop resources, which you can find there. And the resources document not only includes publications that were referenced throughout the meeting, but it also provides some compilation of communication tools and resources that were brought up during the sessions. So links to those have been copied into the chat as well, and they're available again on the webinar homepage under related links. So with that, I think we are ready to get started. Our first presenter today is Dr. Sharon Croissant. She is a tenured professor at the University of Texas Medical Branch, and she is the director of the Community Engagement Corps for the Baylor Rice Superfund Research Program Center. I'm excited to hear what she has to say, and I'm sure you guys are too. Dr. Croissant, over to you.
Okay, can everyone see my slides? And can you hear me?
Yep.
Great.
Good to go.
Okay, great. So as you might expect, I'm going to talk about risk communication strategies today. And the little nod to NOAA is really just a reminder that particularly under disaster conditions, it really is possible to anticipate some of the communications that might be needed and to put in place some of the relationships and the infrastructure to communicate effectively. So just to begin, what I'm going to cover today is what do we really mean when we talk about a disaster? The role of social determinants of health, especially as it relates to disparities, inequities, and social and environmental justice issues. Because those are exacerbated during a disaster. And then to talk about disaster communication and those strategies to think about the impacts of disaster on both individual and communities' capacity for comprehension and understanding, to cover just really to touch on theories for understanding barriers to communication, what are some strategies for dealing with those barriers, and then what can you think about doing before a disaster actually occurs? This is a definition from the Red Cross. And I think it's important to remember that a disaster is any event that exceeds a community or society's ability to cope with the event given its own resources. So, and that's also true for families and individuals as well, that if you don't have very many resources, even a small event can be disastrous or catastrophic, as opposed to a large, very well-resourced community. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with the social determinants of health. This is from Healthy People 2030. But the social determinants of health, those things that affect both your health and your functioning and your quality of life can be grouped into these five domains, including education, access to education, access to healthcare, economic stability, social and community context and support, and either the neighborhood or the built environment. Just to define those a little better and to think about why they might be important, especially during a disaster, is a reminder that, you know, as far as economic stability goes, people who live in poverty are less likely to be healthy to begin with. And as far as education is concerned, especially related to children of low SES or those with disabilities or perhaps who have experienced discrimination, they are less likely to go on to get a higher education and in turn safe or high paying jobs. This will help, we'll talk about this a little later in the context of disaster and some of the things we've been through in the last several years. They're also more likely to develop heart disease, diabetes, and depression, and other chronic illnesses. In terms of healthcare access and quality, people who are underserved either individually because they lack insurance or perhaps they live in underserved areas of the country, they're more likely to lack a primary care provider. They generally have poor access to screening and prevention, and consequently, then they go on to have poor control of chronic illnesses. Regarding the neighborhood or the built environment, we might be talking about the physical environment, but we have to think about, you know, the things that are going on in that environment that that can impact health or safety, and that can be violence or the threat of violence, or living in proximity to industrial or otherwise or facilities, perhaps that so that you have unsafe air or water, or that there's other health and safety risks involved. We know that racial or ethnic minorities and those of lower SES are more likely to be at higher risk. And then for as far as social and community context, we also know that social support reduces negative impacts. But at-risk populations include our elderly, our children, and those who might be isolated from society. So thinking about disparities and inequities and justice in the context of COVID-19. And I bring up COVID-19 because it may be a slow disaster, but it's been a disaster nonetheless, and people have been impacted accordingly. I think in many places with the shutdown, and for us in particular, and the examples I give here are related to the Galveston-Houston area, is that, you know, in some cases, it's been really devastating for local employment. With the non-essential businesses are closed, for us, that's hotels, short-term rentals, cruise ships, restaurants, bars, gyms, parks, shops and stores, our recreational facilities, and many more. Here in our area, unemployment actually exceeded 14%, and almost 230,000 jobs were lost, of which almost 90,000 were among leisure and recreational businesses. If you think about the island, you know, we only have a population of about 50,000, but we host 7 million visitors a year. And the majority, you know, most of our businesses are related to support of the tourist and the travel industry. So lots and lots of people, particularly people who have been, you know, gainfully employed and, you know, for a long time, were suddenly out of a job. And in some cases that was, you know, both the husband and the wife or what, you know, the whatever partners there were. And then there's some unique things that occurred because they've been employed for a while. They may have assets, but no income now, but that precludes them from getting a lot of financial assistance and social services assistance. They may have experienced loss of health insurance. And typically the, you know, a real barrier for them is that they've not had any experience in accessing resources. So related to COVID-19, some of the obvious health and wellness inequities have included disparities in the prevalence and severity of disease. You know, we know, for instance, that the virus has been higher or more dangerous and more serious among communities of color. With the shutdown in particular, not all neighborhoods are created equal. There are some neighborhoods that are very well resourced that, you know, have nice sidewalks. If you don't have those things, you know, it's difficult to get out and exercise. It's difficult for you to take your children out to get fresh air, to get out of the house. Some neighborhoods have parks and playgrounds, others do not. which precludes the ability for children to get out of the house and to socialize with other kids under safe conditions. Depending upon where you live, you may have crime that would preclude your willingness to go out and be exposed to being injured or hurt. And you know, and even if you have a low crime rate, I mean, it also implies that there's that you feel safe and that there's a police presence that is comfortable and not stressed by poor relationships. So, and then those neighborhoods that are in proximity to industry or roadways, that's also a deterrent to outdoor activities. And then we know that there's increased risk of disease and severity of disease in living in areas with higher levels of air pollution. Some of the not so obvious inequities are related to your job and what you're able to do. So service workers have been at highest risk of layoff or termination. Many, at least early in the process when before the eviction was precluded, many were subject to eviction or increased risk of exposure and infection because of combining households, which may be overcrowded. And if someone gets ill, it's difficult to quarantine and to prevent it from spreading to other members of the household. A lot of people who were out of a job have faced increased risk because they've been willing to take higher risk jobs just to keep food on the table and to stay employed. There's been a lot, tremendous amount of stress. We know there's a lot of mental health issues that have gone on, and it impacts those who are already at greatest risk. There's been food insecurity. Because of that, there's been impact on nutrition, and the lowest, people of the lowest SES are less likely to be able to work remotely, perhaps because they lack access to the internet, our reliable internet. And then that also impacts our kids who are expected to remotely school, who may or may not have had this reliable access. Children also, and many kids here in Texas, access, not only have a free lunch program, but free breakfast. And here in Galveston, we actually offer an evening meal at the high school because we do have quite a bit of poverty in children who qualify for those programs. With the schools shut, they weren't getting that nutrition that they would ordinarily be able to access. And then we also have situations where workers were either, when testing was, you had to pay for it in the beginning, workers were either unable to to afford to be tested, or they were actually afraid to be tested for fear of losing their job. So for instance, wait staff or bus staff were leery about being identified as having been exposed or needing to go into quarantine because that meant no money coming in. So context here is really everything. I think that some of you have heard me talk about the disaster within the disaster, because life goes on. And even though COVID-19 has overshadowed pretty much everything, we've also been experiencing other things that, that have in and of themselves have been disasters. We've had such social turmoil, and we've had here in the South, in the last 2 years, we've had unprecedented heat. We had the winter storm Uri that was again unprecedented, where many people went without electricity for quite some time. We've had unprecedented environmental pollution. We had the worst storm season that we've had in years, maybe ever. And then all of this is occurring in the context of COVID, when our hospitals and healthcare systems are overloaded already, and then there's nowhere to send patients when you have these urgent events, acute events. And it's made it very difficult to care for the vulnerable or the ill, or even to think about really resuming our activities of daily living. I mean, there's just kids going back to school has been somewhat of a crisis here, and it's been hashed out in the courts related to, whether or not we can have mandates, and, mandates are legal, and, so in schools nonetheless having to open and trying to make sure that there's not overcrowding and not excess risk of exposure to the children or the faculty. And then think about the mental health and stress. For people who have been through disasters, and many, many of our population have, from the beginning of, COVID, when there were bare grocery store shelves, well, in the context of storms or other events, you see that, and it's really can be quite threatening mentally. It makes you, feel very vulnerable. So some of the added effects from the winter storm and the hurricanes were that, you know, workers have been, again, unable to report for duty. And anyone who's been either displaced or was out of work, you know, now they're facing this added financial stress. And again, food insecurity without without electricity, many people's food spoiled. And going back to the social determinants of health, depending upon what your resources are, that can actually be a catastrophe. If you're on a fixed income and maybe so during the freeze, you know, we're afraid to move your food outside so it wouldn't spoil. But, you know, if you do end up losing your food, it's not easy to replace it if you have few resources. And in this case, where, you know, the food banks were really decimated, you know, they were already providing much more for many more people. And now, you know, they've lost a lot of their stuff too. So it's been very difficult for them to meet the increased need. And that's also true for those who needed, who were displaced by the lack of shelter, you know, or shelter with electricity. You know, we had people that had to make a choice, either to go to a shelter where it's likely to be overcrowded and they would risk exposure, or to stay where they're, you know, it was 20 degrees and risked, you know, real risk of death. So thinking about all these things, you know, the slow disasters, the fast disasters, you know, the acute events, what can we do? What do we need to be able to do in terms of engagement and risk communication? Well, we need to inform people of what risks they face. We need to enable them to make informed decisions for themselves and their families. And we really need to work with the emergency response to be able to get our messaging out, because that's where people will be getting information. So important things to do in advance are building trust and engaging populations that are likely to be impacted, to think about integrating efforts with those existing systems, and then to develop, you know, established and effective risk communication strategies. So building trust, it's really important that that our communications be linked to the accessible services, and they need to be, this is not rocket science. It needs to be transparent and timely. It needs to be easy to understand. So think about translation to other languages, or for people who perhaps don't read well or for whom literacy is a problem. So it needs to be specific to the affected populations. It needs to empower people. And above all, you need to use multiple dissemination platforms. It's really critical to communicate even under uncertainty and to be honest about what we don't know. And to ensure people and make them feel that they are safe, and that, you know, as information becomes available, that it will be made available to them. And again, above all, I think it's really in advance, it's really important to build relationships with the trusted members of the community, because those are the individuals who can evoke change, that they will be involved in making decisions at the community level and to promote decisions at the family and individual levels. So it's important to have those relationships in place beforehand. So again, driving home that these things can all be done, but many things can be done in advance. And I think it's really important to be sensitive to community needs. They should be participatory in nature. You can't anticipate what barriers to communication might exist if you haven't engaged your community in advance. And then do your homework. You really need to evaluate what it is that you're trying to do, evaluate those relationships, evaluate methods and strategies and dissemination points and get feedback on that before you actually need to use that under disaster circumstances. And we all know that social media is a tool. Whether or not it's effective depends upon how we use it and who we engage to use it, but it can be effectively used, and really we need to build bridges to make sure that it's not poorly used, you know, to promote misinformation. So to get to some of the risk communication practices, much of this is based upon the work of Dr. Vincent Cavello. I'm going to remind you all that this is actually science-based, and that under high concern situations, the rules of communication change, and your methods of communicating probably need to change. This is all based upon some theories: trust determination, mental noise, negative dominance, and risk perception. We're not going to cover this in any detail, except how they impact how you might do things. So these are some of the core principles to remember, that when people are stressed, and they're chronically stressed right now, but especially when something, you know, when a disaster is unfolding, people need to know that you care before they care what you know. That's based on trust determination, that they literally have difficulty hearing, understanding, and remembering information when they're stressed, which is mental noise, that they focus most on what they hear first, also related to mental noise theory, that they often focus on the negative rather than the positive, which is negative dominance, and that there are gaps between risk perceptions and reality, and that those gaps become wider when they're very stressed. So that's risk perception theory. So I'm going to give you just a couple of several examples of risk communication strategies or guidelines. One is just to demonstrate compassion, conviction, and optimism. We'll talk about the rules of three, and then, you know, parsing down your messages to make sure that they're comprehensible. And then we'll talk about average grade level. So in high stress situations, people are not only stressed, but they're often tired and afraid. You might be too, depending upon what you've been doing during this time. It's important to remember that when you begin talking, that people can assess whether you care and whether you demonstrate empathy or compassion in the first 90 to 30 seconds. So you really need to think about not only what you're going to say, but how you say it. And then to a lesser extent, they're also evaluating whether or not they believe you're competent or that you're honest and trustworthy. So it is important to anticipate as many needs as possible in advance, but also to be kind to yourself and to be aware of where you are before you actually put yourself in the situation. So to deal with some of the mental noise, by putting everything in threes, there's a couple of different ways you can do this, either to give three related key messages or to repeat the same message three times, but maybe slightly different format, or to provide one key message that's provided by three supporting messages of credible sources. And I'm going to share all of this. I have Dr. Covello's permission to share many materials that he's given us, and I'm happy to share. So these are just some of the strategies to remember that we can do. First, identify what your community is likely to be exposed to. What are the highest risks? We know here on the coast that flooding is always a risk. Mold is always a risk. We have to deal with storms. Identify your key stakeholders. Who are you going to use to help you promote your risk communication and to disseminate information? Now, rather than waiting, identify what stakeholder questions and concerns are likely to be. Go ahead and develop those materials and key messages consistent with your with the key risk communication principles we've talked about briefly today. And then to develop that supporting information, have your materials ready to go. When I say conduct testing, I mean, you know, pilot test your messaging. Make sure that people really have an understanding of what it is that you're trying to convey. And then have your plan for delivery. And that's all about, you know, setting in place those relationships that you need to be effective. And that was what I had.
Sorry, I sometimes cover up my my camera, so I make sure that I'm not seen when I don't want to be seen. But thank you, Sharon, very much. That was a very interesting presentation. You know, I especially resonated when you were talking a bit about sort of the trauma background, right, and how that can really impact the messages that are heard and how they're understood and acted on. So we're going to have some questions now. I just want to remind our listeners to put, if they have questions for you, to use the Q&A pod to put them in. And I'm going to get started with the first question, which is, you talked a little bit at the outset about the importance of preparing in advance. And that's a really important strategy, is to do that sort of advanced work. Can you give some examples of what types of topics might be suitable for that preparation in advance?
Yeah, I already touched on one, which is flooding. You know, I mean, really, we've all been through that, particularly with Hurricane Harvey, when so much of the Gulf Coast flooded. We know those are our issues. And so the opportunity to develop and keep current messaging about flooding, I think that's critical. And I think it's really important to engage the stakeholders. We've had changes in leadership, for instance, in the Galveston-Houston area. And not everyone has the same communication style. They may not even be aware of things that we've done in the past. So I think it's really important to maintain those relationships. And, you know, we in science, to be honest with you, we work according to grant cycles. And with disasters, they don't tend to, really nicely and neatly fit into those grant cycles. So I think it's really important in terms of engagement to maintain those relationships, whether or not we have grant funding in place to promote those efforts.
I may make it just a side plug for the National Science Foundation, because I used to actually work for them, and they do have some mechanisms that allow you, after disasters, it's called a rapid grant, and you guys probably know about that, but there are some mechanisms out there that are meant to help with that issue. But I think it is an important issue, and having those relationships is definitely critical before you start. I wonder if you could speak a little bit too about the ways in which you try to reach your audiences. One of the things that I think, at least where I sit in EPA, is we sometimes don't put enough thought about whether people are actually getting the message, right? Like, we put the message out there, but thinking about how you actually reach your audiences, and I believe you had some sort of unique ways to do that in your project, so.
Yeah, we're trying some new things. You know, of course, you know, it always happens when a disaster, you know, you find more about things that don't work well than things that do work well. And so we've had some conversations with our local health authorities about communication of risk. And one of the things that I think is important is, you know, risk communication sometimes depends on who you are and who you represent. So if we have, for instance, an industrial release, as forthcoming as the companies might want to be, they are in some ways restricted as to what they can say in the absence of certainty. But health risk communication has to be informed by facts and evidence. So we work with the local health authority, not only to put out good information, but to dispel bad information. So one of the things that we realized early on is that we needed to reach out to some of the primary socially networking sites here in our local community to identify, because we could look at that and see that a lot of bad information was going through channels. And so what we're doing now is educating the administrators to be that they will have a line to the health, to public health, and that we will get them as updated information as quickly as we can, and they'll know the timeline, so that when people start putting a lot of information out there that's conjecture or perhaps just wrong, that they can say, actually, this isn't based on what we're hearing from the local health authorities. We'll be doing an update in 30 minutes, you know, those are some of the things that we're doing. Just, you know, it doesn't necessarily increase your capacity for conveying good information. Sometimes it does, but it does reduce the amount of bad information going out.
Well, and it gets you closer to your audience, right?
That's right. Well, right, because we need to know what they're saying.
Right. And I wonder, and this is not a part of question for audience, this is my end, but I'll turn to the audience questions in just a second. But I wonder if you do any distinguishment between misinformation, so sort of just like wrong information, and disinformation, which is sort of intentionally motivated rumor spreading that is intended to be wrong.
I understand exactly what you're saying. Under disaster circumstances, it's usually misinformation, you know, I mean, because it's people just don't know what's going on, but everyone, you know, has an opinion, or they want to, you know, to think that maybe they know what's going on. But so it's less likely to be intentional, just because people haven't had a chance to react that intentionally yet. But I do take your point. And one of the things that we've tried to do, at least with COVID messaging, is so, for example, we did a TikTok challenge, where we challenged our youth to look at some of the disinformation that was out there. And we don't give them the cues. We ask them to dispel it, and then for them to make up their mind, and then to make TikTok videos about, you know, in response to the disinformation. And that's been really helpful for us because they're much more likely to listen to, you know, an 18 something, you know, year old who's really approaching it from their perspective as opposed to mine.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that sounds like fun. Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking of it in the context of vaccines, right? One of the things that we say at EPA is that, you know, when it comes to preparedness this year, vaccines are the best thing you can do to be prepared. But some people don't want to hear that message, as I'm sure you have encountered. So do that. It's personally interesting to me. Let me turn to one of the questions from the Q&A panel. So what do you think, Sharon, is the best way to train scientists about risk communication as they build their science communication literacy and skills?
We do a variety of things, and it started out like really torturous and really, you know, really awful, but and it's turned into, you know, to a lot of fun. So we do a couple of things. We start with our trainees. We do a thing called T1 through T4 and 3, which is similar to the 3-minute thesis, but what we're doing is training our scientists, and now we've opened it up to our junior faculty, but how to convey messages in 3 minutes or less in layman's terms and to get their point across. And then we have People's Choice Awards. So it's not based upon what other scientists, it's based upon what people from everyday walks of life get from what you're saying. And I think it's really, you know, it's really been transformational because they realize, you know, I really, you know, this works anywhere. It works in many, many, they can now go to a professional meeting and strike up a conversation with someone in line, you know, for food and, you know, tell them who I am, what I do, and what's intriguing about my work. And that also works for risk communication. So we are doing, you know, working, well, actually our health authority is our public health authority is here on campus, and he's done a tremendous amount of making sure that communication is clear and succinct.
We have about 2 minutes left and we have 2 questions. So if you can keep the answers to these brief, I think we'll get them through. So one is, how would you suggest dealing with community members who have been targeted by deliberate misinformation? So I think we sort of already talked about that in my question on disinformation. I didn't even realize that it was aligned with mine, but I don't know if you have anything additional to say.
Well, I think you have to, I think this is one of those where your community partners are critical for this, because a lot of times, in the last year or so, science has been suspect. You know, we've been, you know, I mean, we've been accused of having ulterior motives or ourselves of spreading disinformation. So I think it's best when it comes from a trusted community member to help dispel some of those myths.
And the last one of these that we're going to get to right now is the rule of three is great, but how do you know how to sort of pare it down to three and what three you should be looking at? I'm sorry, my dog is all excited.
That's okay.
Yeah. And does it depend on the crisis?
Yeah. And so an example of that, we live in the midst of, you know, one of the biggest industrial complexes in the country. And so it's not that unoften that we have shelter in place orders. And so one of the things that we might do, a message of three, will be a shelter in place has been called for. This means that you need to shelter indoors at the closest possible facility. Close your doors, close your windows, seal them in as much as possible. Do not come out until you've been given the all clear. That's an example of a message of three where you've told them what they need to do, which is to seek shelter, how to do that, how to be as safe as they can, and to stay tuned for information. That's an example, but Dr. Covello has a book coming out. And he has a handbook that he developed for WHO that's got a ton of strategies in there that are so helpful because they're just really, you know, down to earth and realistic.
Yeah, no, I think that's great information. I think it's time to turn to our next speaker, but there were a handful of other questions in the Q&A, and so maybe you can take a look at those and we can make sure they're addressed before the end of the call today. So next up we have Al Richmond, who is the Executive Director of Community Campus Partnerships for Health and the co-lead of the Community Engagement Core for the RADUP, I don't know if I'm doing that one right, RADUP Coordinating and Data Collection Center. Mr. Richmond, please take it away.
Hey, good afternoon, and thank you. I'm going to get to my slides here. Yeah, what a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Croissant, for actually setting me up really nice. That's a nice cue up for what I will be sharing with you this afternoon. I'm Al Richmond, Executive Director of Community Campus Partnerships for Health, and I'll talk some about the Say Yes COVID Test Project, Mobilizing Communities for Action. The RADx Up is part of a national initiative by the National Institutes of Health in response to the global pandemic of COVID-19. RADx Up, Rapid Acceleration of Diagnostics for Underserved Populations, partners with communities most affected by the pandemic. Our intent is to provide testing access to communities who've been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. And these are images from across the U.S. of communities where we are working, all the way from kind of the growing fields of California and Florida to local communities near all of us. And it's our pleasure to do this work. None of us could have anticipated or even imagined that almost 2 years later, actually, that we would be still in the middle of this global pandemic. The RADx Up project allows us to really look across the country, reach out and identify communities that, again, have been impacted by COVID-19 and increased testing access in those communities. Today, I'll focus primarily, our work is very massive, but I'll focus on a narrow part or aspect of our work today. I want to acknowledge the RADx Up team. This is part of the Coordination Data Collection Center of RADx Up. Our principal investigators, Mickey Kornwokovich, Giselle Corby-Smith, and Warren Kibbe. I'm very honored to be the co-lead of the Community Engagement Corps, along with Dr. Krista Pereira, that's committed to increasing the capacity of RADx Up to work in partnership with community leaders in response, again, to increasing testing access to communities. We're supported by over 100 operational support staff members. In this particular work, I want to acknowledge our community leaders who have been a part of our work as part of the Say Yes COVID Test Project in Greenville, North Carolina, and Chattanooga, Tennessee. I will share some of the results of that work and describe it, and I think that it builds upon the previous presentation. The overarching goal of RADx Up is certainly community-engaged research, and it's also to evaluate how to increase uptake and access to COVID-19 tests in underserved populations. The project was launched last fall or fall of 2020. In phase one, there were 69 projects that were funded by the National Institutes of Health. In the spring of this year, we launched two special supplements. The first one was the Say Yes COVID Test Project that I will describe and share with you this afternoon, but also the Safe Return to School Diagnostic Testing Initiative. We have 16 projects so far in that particular initiative. In the fall of this year, now we are onboarding an additional 40 projects, again, to expand and increase testing access to local communities at a time when many individuals are focused on the vaccine. We continue to acknowledge that testing is an ongoing process of mitigating the spread of COVID-19. In particular, I want to talk some again about the Say Yes COVID Test Project, and this was a goal that was launched by the National Institutes of Health in coordination with the Coordination Data Collection Center. It's a public health intervention with an ecological analysis component to provide 80,000 households across two communities in phase one with the opportunity to test frequently at home to reduce SARS-CoV-2 community transmission. The objectives were quite robust, and they included to promote health, public health intervention through community engagement and widespread advertising and marketing communications. The goal was to really center community engagement as a strategy to really reach the most vulnerable in our communities and our cities around increasing access to testing, to analyze outcome variables such as prevalence and incidence of SARS-CoV-2 and through wastewater surveillance. This is an observational cohort sub-study, and the sub-study looks at potential socio-behavioral mechanisms of SARS-CoV-2 community transmission, including social interactions, health behaviors, healthcare utilization, knowledge, disease burden, and feasibility of at-home testing. We did prioritize African-Americans and other racial and ethnic minorities as part of this particular project because we're working with underserved populations. There was a questionnaire that was part of the project that captured basic demographic and medical information. Our study hypothesis is that of a positive at-home test result will be associated with altered self-reported social interactions and altered health behaviors compared to negative test results. So this is the actual box. This contained 25 test kits in each box. And our goal was to, as part of this public health opportunity, to make 40,000 free rapid self-administered COVID-19 test kits available in phase one in two communities, Greenville, Pitt County, which is a rural community in Eastern North Carolina, and Chattanooga, Tennessee. Individuals were able to get the kits through two mechanisms. There was an online order process where individuals could order the test kits online through just accessing the portal, placing their contact information, address, and within days they would receive a test kit. Secondly, was the strategy of receiving a kit through direct community engagement. Tests could be picked up from one of multiple community sites, and I'll describe some of those sites that we were able to stand up as part of that. I want to acknowledge the amazing partnerships of community organizations, faith-based groups, and others in Greenville and in Chattanooga, Tennessee, who supported this work. It was absolutely amazing, and I think the pictures that I'm sharing with you will allow you to see that. We use a three-step process in messaging. We wanted individuals to test three times a week, and so it was like 2-3-0. First, it was designed to that two people in the household would test, two individuals in the household would test three times per week until all the tests were done. So it's 2-3-0, two individuals testing three times a week until all the tests were gone. We had an extra test kit in there in case one of the tests were spoiled. So that was important. It was a very simple message, two individuals per kit, three times a week until all the tests were gone. So our partners and stakeholders include a number of partners, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the Duke Clinical Research Institute, our organization, Community Campus Partnerships for Health, and a myriad of other organizations, including Quidel, which is the manufacturer of the test kit, was involved in this particular project, in addition to a number of community organizations, faith-based groups, and others. The project, we launched this kind of early in January as we began to talk about it. Emergency use authorization was obtained for the test kits in March. We were excited that actually prior to launching, we had full approval through the FDA for the test kits. We launched the project with some delay around Mother's Day in Pitt County, North Carolina. We decided to actually kind of do a two-tiered approach wherein we would launch one community and through rapid cycle feedback, we would receive that feedback and then phase in the second site, which was in Tennessee. The analysis continues. We continue to analyze the data and we'll be reporting back first to community leaders and organizations and residents about the results of the testing project. So I want to share a little bit about the results of the project, looking specifically at Pitt County, and then also Chattanooga. What you will see is the really amazing work of our community partners and kind of the teal color that in Pitt County, at this point in the project, the community groups and organizations, our community partners, had actually distributed at least 47% of the kits. We now, some kits are still on the ground, but most of them have now been, our supply there has been depleted. You will note that at that point, when we were looking at the data, that only 14% of the kits were actually distributed online. This is very telling. And what this highlights is the importance of community engagement. We were working with community leaders in both communities who were really excited at the opportunity to be engaged in this public health intervention. These were community leaders, faith-based leaders who had been leading a number of other initiatives around responding to COVID-19, such that when we approached them, they were, you know, really jumped at the opportunity to be part of this work. They felt that this was so vitally important to their communities, was an additional offering or strategy that they could support their communities. When looking at Chattanooga at this point in time, that 62% of the kits were actually distributed through our community partners. So community partners were essential and critical to the distribution of the kits. I mean, that was our goal, and we hypothesized that if we could mobilize community partners, that they would be interested in this work. We supported them financially through their engagement, and we'll describe some of those activities that they were engaged in. In terms of the public health campaign, this was a full-scale marketing campaign in Pitt County, North Carolina, and in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And what you see here is that some of these strategies that we used, including large billboards, door knockers, flyers, even large post-its on at bus stops and even on buses and other public transportation systems. We used our website, the Say Yes COVID Test website, posters, videos, and outdoor advertising. This was a full-scale marketing campaign. One could hardly go anywhere in Pitt County or in Chattanooga, Hamilton County, Tennessee, without seeing some of the messages around, you know, get your free test kit. We emphasized that these were free. We emphasized the 230, and we emphasized say yes. So this was really important that we wanted to kind of like shift the messaging that was out there and encouraging people to just simply say yes to being tested, right? That was a simple, straightforward message that would resonate with individuals. We also used other kind of specific messaging that was very localized. So it wasn't just generic. So it was say yes, COVID test, join the free at-home testing challenge in Pitt County. We felt that this would resonate with people in Pitt County. We also had a COVID test Chattanooga as well. So we wanted to personalize this so that people felt like this was part of or saying yes to a community-wide initiative that deeply resonated with them. We used Facebook page or Instagram and Twitter. And I want to acknowledge that in particular around social influencers, there were individuals in both communities that had really large social followings. And this is something that I think that as public health leaders and other, you know, people who are engaged in this, you know, one of the things I recognize is that as we counter disinformation, we are under-resourced and at times actually ill-prepared to engage in kind of a full frontal throttle attack against disinformation. And I think that this really represents the next frontier in terms of social media, that is, of being able to really think about how to launch public health campaigns. I remember attending health communication training years ago. It was very basic, you know, and so now people are receiving messages through multiple channels. And I think that those of us who engage in this work have to embrace social media, and it changes so rapidly. But in particular, the role of social influencers. These were local leaders who were part of this project who used their Facebook page or other channels to actually increase awareness of the project. What you see here is a pop-up tent. We had the tents were branded, the tabletop information, and also we had tabletop stands that people could actually use. Everything was tailored specifically to the local community so that at these, what we call pop-up events, which were interesting, these were sometimes at churches, businesses, allowed us to just set up a table outside of a convenience store, even on street corners, heavy traffic street corners, people could actually stop, pull over and pick up a test kit. In terms of the messaging evolution, this shows you that we kind of really started with our initial messaging around join the challenge to 230, right? Three tests a week. You know, that's what we wanted to drive home, that this was an opportunity to do this in the privacy of your own home. We then evolved to some personal stories. And this is Bishop Tripp in from Greenville, North Carolina, and Dr. Eve Savage from Greenville, North Carolina, both social influencers. Bishop Tripp is a pastor and head of a church group in the region. And he actually, both of them were leaders in our project, and they did testimonials around why they test. So we wanted to make this very personal to them. These are individuals who have credibility. They have trust. They're trusted sources of information, and they were able to lend their celebrity, if you will, to this project by sharing why they test. We then focused on the free nature of it. Get your free test kit, such that we wanted to emphasize removing any of the barriers that people might have. And then we moved next to highlighting other aspects of remaining safe in COVID-19 and the COVID-19 environment. I will say that it was kind of like the first phase was the distribution phase, and then it was like test, right? We also benefited from a lot of national media, and both communities were just amazed at how national media sources, including CBS Morning News, the Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, and many others actually came to Greenville and to Chattanooga to have to interview local leaders. People were interested in people doing this work. I mean, that's part of communication, is that you need people. It's not just the printed text. It's about having believable people, you know, on the ground. So they visited churches. This was launched to coincide with Mother's Day. We built upon that. You see these images here inside of church. And so these, the national media really brought attention to it, so much so there were people beginning to contact us from outside of our community, these priority communities, wanting to participate in the project. But this certainly heightened the awareness of the campaign locally and made people really understand, like, wow, that they were part of something that was really pivotal, something that was important, that this was a really transformative moment for the nation as we were able to offer at-home tests. Again, these are images of our community partners in action. We had literally drive-bys in the lower left corner. The American Legion stood up events in front of their location, churches, again, street corners. You see people mask, protecting themselves, but being active in supporting their community at a time when they wanted to do something and they wanted to be involved. So in terms of the general project awareness, 80% of Pitt County residents were aware of the general availability of at-home COVID-19 tests. That's a phenomenal number. And that was possible because we used a multimedia campaign as well as just community organizations to get the message out. 41% of the people who had not received a free test kit. 34% of all residents did not want one. So test kits were readily available. Individuals who, you know, show through these results that people who wanted them had access to them. Others refused them. There were a lot of issues there with people on different ends of the political spectrum who simply did not and refused a kit. This shows kind of the distribution of our general awareness around the project in terms of the sources. 34% were aware of this through TV or radio advertisement, 32% social media, and then 12% community or organizations. So there were a number of strategies that really did prove effective in helping us to get the message out across our priority audience, which was African-Americans and the Latinx community. In terms of the public health campaign results, we were able to name and brand the entire effort, which was very important. We were able to personalize it, if you will, or localize it based on each community. We supported online ordering of over 20,000 test kits. You see here information around the number of impressions that were on the website as well. And we just think in general that we were able to build really strong community partnerships, which, interesting enough, we're actually going into a new phase of the Say Yes Project in Greenville, North Carolina, but also, as you know, across the U.S. and other communities as well. The program success is that at the time we were looking at this particular, I was preparing this presentation, we delivered over 63,000 COVID-19 tests into homes. This was successfully launched in both communities with lessons learned that will influence us in the future. Also, as we think about scaling up, these lessons are going to be critically important. We developed really close partnerships with both the health departments in Pitt County, North Carolina, and Hamilton County, Tennessee. This was a tight timeline in terms of some of the challenges. We felt like we did not have sufficient time to really make some of the inroads and deeply into some of these communities. But in spite of that, through our connections into the community and because of their interest, we were able to really have deep impact. There are other challenges around marketing that we learned as well. I will share, as I alluded to earlier, that we also began to recognize that our messaging was important because this was a highly polarizing topic, and that it met some resistance from some sectors and some individuals, again, refused the test kits. And that's important as part of a message to understand the local geopolitical environment in which you're operating. We had to moderate social media and dispelling misinformation about the test kits and all. There was that information out there that actually by testing, you actually were actually inserting the vaccine or the virus in your nostrils. So there were a lot of just misinformation that we had to counter as well. And again, finally, a large portion of the population did not want a test kit. I want to thank you for your time this afternoon and want to make myself available for any questions that you have.
Great. Thank you so much, Al. And we do have a couple of questions in already, so I will just turn to those. But I very much enjoyed the presentation. I have my own questions, but I want to turn to audience questions first. Those are more important. In your experience, what role can and do religious leaders play in public health initiatives? Do you think they're engaged enough? And if not, what advice would you have for engaging religious leaders more often?
A great question. We encountered that, I would say, in particular, in both communities. In some instances, it was very positive. I mentioned Bishop Tripp, who is a religious leader in the Pitt County region. Many African-American pastors were very supportive of this. I mean, they... and their leadership readily opened their churches up to be distribution sites. We did compensate our community partners, including churches, for their participation in the project. I would say that they're just seminal to this work. My work over 20 years has has really centered, in particular, the African-American church in public health messaging. And yet we also recognize that at this moment, this is a very polarizing issue in that on the other hand, you have some religious leaders that are opposed to this kind of work. So maybe to sum it up, it's a make it or break it in some instances. It just depends who's delivering the message and what the message is.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how you reach the religious leaders that you work with.
So we reached out through trusted sources. We identified partners at each of the health departments, but we also reached out to, you know, to groups, to pastors who we were made aware of. We started the project by asking a small group of people, if this project was to launch in your community, who are the leaders? A very basic and simple question. Who are the leaders that we should engage? And people were quick to respond and say, you absolutely should engage this person. This person has a real bent towards social justice and health equity. You can't come into our community unless you work with Bishop this person or this particular pastor. And so, you know, it was really just referrals. In some instances, people were willing to volunteer their church, their pastor or leader, or religious leader to be a part of the project. Very few said no. Most said yes. With some, it took some time. The other thing I would say, Madeline, is that these are busy people, right? People were dealing with a lot in their own personal lives. The pastors were facing, you know, their own health challenges at time, and they were also engaged in burying the dead and comforting people. Right. During COVID-19. So, you know, we had to be very sensitive to where they were coming from. But, you know, again, overall, very positive.
Wonderful. And good to hear. It's sort of like a modified waterfall, I guess, in terms of finding your surrogates, your on the ground folks. Yeah. I've got a question here. That is your data shows that people preferred to get their test kits through a community partner, at least especially in Pitt County, but also I believe in Chattanooga too. You also spoke about the value of community and social media influencers. Do you think people were open to hearing about the project online, but wanted to interact with real humans in person to actually get the test kits, or was it something else? Can you speak?
I think it was just that. I think that they heard about it online, they saw it on the television, they may have read about it in the newspaper, saw flyers, billboards, right? They couldn't go anywhere to escape the message. But when it came to actually getting a kit, they wanted to receive that kit from someone who they knew. And I think there was a trust factor. I think that there were a number of things that were at play with that. And also there were issues also around just Wi-Fi access in some of our communities. Eastern North Carolina has significant problems and challenges around Wi-Fi. And so some individuals just simply could not order online, or seniors that did not have smartphones and other devices that would allow them to, or a laptop or desktop that allow them to order online. But they could access one, pick up a kit at the, especially if it was at, you know, at church after service, you know, at a local convenience store, at a park in their community. Yeah. We made it available and accessible and easy to get. So we were removing those barriers.
Yeah. And there's a question I want to ask, but I'll save it for the panel, but I'll put a pin in it now. It's around stigma and privacy, because I think you talked about it a little bit, but I want to make sure we've got one more question that we're going to get to from the attendees, and then we're going to move on. But just a reminder, sure. Extra questions, we're going to have a panel, so you can ask them then. The next one I want to ask is, I guess, real technical and the practical application of how you were working misinformation on social media. Did you actually delete comments, respond to them? How did you actually deal with misinformation that you saw popping up on social media without sort of opening a dialogue that may have actually elevated the argument?
Yeah, that I'm aware of, we didn't really coordinate any campaign specifically around disinformation. I think that what our approach was to give people accurate information. At the time of the launching of this project, we did kind of distinguish this from the vaccine, which is even more controversial, quite frankly, in some circles. And so we really focused on testing at home. We did prioritize, I didn't mention this earlier, around people who did not have the privilege of staying at home. And so that was important. But the misinformation through social influencers, through religious leaders and community groups, I think they were able to kind of like quell or squelch mm-hmm. any kind of negative information. We did train them. So there was opportunities for them to interface with the PIs and others around any misinformation. But I think we chose in some ways to kind of like minimize that and marginalize it over, as opposed to trying to, you know, counter every negative message that we were hearing. There were times when people did infiltrate our Facebook and all of that, but, you know, that was soon kind of quieted by the positive.
That's great advice. We've got a couple of extra questions in here. Perhaps you can see too as we move on so that we make sure they're answered. But we also, again, we have a panel at the end, and some of these are ripe for sort of bigger perspective questions. So
thank you.
So now I'm going to turn it to Louis Rivers, Dr. Rivers is an associate professor at the North Carolina State University, and he works in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources. So Louis, thank you so much. I look forward to hearing from you next. Take it away.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Let me go ahead and share my screen. Okay. So thank you to the other presenters. I'm incredibly interested in presentations, and I'm hoping that my presentation will connect with what we've heard a little bit already. So I'm going to focus on a smaller scale, really on work with two neighborhoods in Southeast Raleigh, and I'm thinking about engaging this Black community. So Southeast Raleigh is home to the first Black neighborhoods in Raleigh, and like a lot of these early Black neighborhoods throughout the Southeast and really most of the country, it's located in kind of low-lying land. So these neighborhoods, Rochester Heights and Biltmore Hills, are at the bottom of the Walnut Creek watershed. So they often are prone to flooding. This flooding is often nuisance flooding, but also it can be pretty serious flooding at times, which you can tell from this picture. So if we get a hurricane, there's a good chance that there'll be serious flooding in these neighborhoods in Southeast Raleigh. So considering that these neighborhoods are the bottom of this watershed, oh, I think I may have skipped the slide here. There we go. An important thing to also think about these neighborhoods are that they are, like I said before, they are majority Black neighborhoods historically. There's some gentrification going on right now, but they're historically Black neighborhoods, and they're at the bottom of this watershed. And for those of us who work at North Carolina State University, I think eventually we realize that this is something that we need to think about seriously, because we actually contribute to this flooding with our buildings. So the addition of impervious surface in the watershed usually leads to greater flooding in these neighborhoods. Particularly with the building of our Centennial campus, which has been built over the last 25 years, it's been a significant amount of impervious surface added to the watershed, and it has not helped conditions nuisance flooding in these neighborhoods. So this responsibility on the part of the university to these communities was recognized in 2014 by two people, Dr. Deidre Crumbly, a sociology professor at NC State, and Christy Perrin, who works for the Water Resources Research Institute, kind of an extension arm of the university. And then both of these people realized that there's a responsibility on the part of the university to think about our impact on these local communities, and to also think about how can we communicate or help these communities think about the risk associated with flooding. And that led to the formation of the Walnut Creek Wetland Community Project in 2014. So like I said, this project really started with Dr. Crumbly and Christy Perrin, and they realized that if we wanted to get anything done in these neighborhoods, we need to reach out to city partners. So they reached out first to gentleman on your left, Kevin Boyer, who was the head of stormwater for Raleigh. And then the other gentleman on your right, I guess, I'm not sure how that works out, but the other gentleman, David Schaus, who was a representative of the Raleigh Parks. Then finally, they reached out to Stacy Hagwood, who was the director of the Walnut Creek Wetland Center, which was this wetland center that had been placed right on the periphery of the neighborhoods. So for about, I would say 4 or 5 months, those of us at the university met with the people in the city to really think about how can we think about these issues of flooding in these neighborhoods. Of course, we realized that you just can't have university people at the table, and you just can't have city people at the table. You need actually people who are representatives of the community at the table, which are critically important, which was alluded to in previous presentations. So we reached out to, going from left to right, Dr. Norman Camp, who was founder of the influential organization Partners for Environmental Justice in Raleigh. Reverend Jermon Taylor, who was the pastor of St. Ambrose Episcopal Church, was right in the heart of the community, and his church often experienced flooding. And then finally, Amin Davis, who worked for the state of North Carolina and the Environmental Department of Quality, but was also deeply involved in Partners for Environmental Justice and working in the community. So really for a whole year, the year of 2014, we worked together to think about how can we think about talking or working with these communities to think about the risk associated with nuisance flooding and what are things that we can do to examine this risk and help people better understand this risk and maybe potentially, you know, address these risks associated with flooding. So the first thing that kind of came out of that, the first concrete thing that kind of came out of that is that we really need to talk to community members and find out what they really thought about what was going on in their neighborhoods in relation to flooding. So we held a focus group in 2015, led by a graduate student, Dresden McGregor, pictured here. And it engaged residents in Rochester Heights and Biltmore Hills. And initially we were really thinking about this idea of stormwater and green infrastructure, which is one of the lessons I'll talk about at the end of this presentation, but we kind of went to the neighborhoods thinking about what are some technical ideas or some ideas that we think would be good, and let's examine those. And we were quickly disabused of those notions by talking to residents in the neighborhood, which I'll get to on the next slide. But our participants in the focus groups were highly educated. They were long-term residents, average of 30 years, had a high value for the natural environment, and they're all Black women. And I mentioned that point because I think the fact that the focus groups were all Black women, I think provided a safe space for these women to speak out. And also, I think we got more information on these focus groups than if we had had different members, or if we had a more heterogeneous focus group. I had one focus group member tell us that she felt like this is a place where she could come and talk to us. And I think Dresden was also responsible for that because she was young and she was very humble in the way that she approached the members of the focus group. So I have this focus group. There's a slight delay. There we go. Out of that focus group, a couple themes were really highlighted. Like I said before, this high value on the natural environment on the part of the residents, a high general awareness around the environment. But conversely, there was little trust in the city. So these neighborhoods, Rochester Heights and Biltmore Hills, had actually been one neighborhood. And in 1969, a highway was put through the middle of that neighborhood, which divided it in half, which happened to a lot of minority communities, especially Black communities across the Southeast and Northeast during that time period. So even though that may have been a federal decision, I think that started the distrust between residents and city officials and government officials in general. There was a high support and interest in green infrastructure, but they also felt like there was a need to assess the flooding and the stream conditions in the neighborhoods. They felt like they needed more technical information to help them make better decisions on their own about what to do in their neighborhood. And then finally, they really brought this idea that there's a need for access to green space. There's a park right on the edge of the neighborhood where the wetland center is located at, but residents of these two neighborhoods are not able to access that park without a 20-minute walk across two fairly busy roads. Sorry, there's a slight lag in the change of slides. So we really took these last three points as kind of marching orders for our group as something to focus on. This idea of thinking about how can we examine this interest in green infrastructure, How can we think about assessing flood and stream conditions in the neighborhoods, and how can we make provide better access to green space, which is kind of a tall order. So that led to our pursuit in 2016 of a small grant from the American Rivers, a nonprofit that operates in trying to help communities address river conditions in their neighborhood. And American Rivers provided us with a small grant. And with that grant, we were able to do two things. First, we installed a demonstration rain garden at St. Ambrose Episcopalian Church. And we wanted to provide an example of green infrastructure that the community could see, and also that the community would have some ownership over. And we thought St. Ambrose was a perfect partner for doing this. And also the city of Raleigh partnered with us and cost share on the cost of installing that rain garden. We also used the funds provided by American Rivers to do a study of the stream of flooding in the neighborhood. Specifically, we focused on where is water more likely to accumulate in the neighborhood? What are the local residents' knowledge of accumulation? So Dresden McGregor, the graduate student I mentioned earlier, and Stacey Supak did a GIS study in which they looked at the accumulation of water in the neighborhood using GIS. They also did a door-to-door survey in which they asked residents in the neighborhood to identify areas that flood according to their own knowledge. And what came up, and the result of that study was that the residents had a really accurate knowledge of what flooding occurred in the neighborhood that corresponded really well to GIS. So again, there's another lesson that the local community members have a lot of knowledge, and we need to really make time to listen to what they know about their community. In 2016, we also used some of that money to think about creating greater knowledge around green infrastructure. So we worked with a neighborhood ecology corps, which is a group of middle school and high school students who meet weekly at the Walnut Creek Wetland Center. Most of the students live in the two neighborhoods, and they do environmental activities once a week. So we met with them and we did a workshop around green infrastructure. And then a month later, we had them give that same workshop to their parents. So we're hoping that we can increase knowledge around green infrastructure via the children. And I think we got better turnout from the parents than we would if they were just coming to hear us talk about green infrastructure. In 2016 and 17, we used the rest of the grant funded to support Dr. Ryan Emanuel and his postdoc POJs to assess stream conditions within the community. So they did stream gauges of two large tributaries, which often cause nuisance flooding in the communities for about 8 months. And we use that information to provide the citizens, our participants, the citizens in the neighborhood, with more accurate technical information around the stream conditions. And we were able to assess a variety of stream conditions during that time period. So in 2018, if you remember the last thing that came out of the focus groups was this idea for green space. So we were able to, we were funded by the Conservation Fund as part of their Park with Purposes program. This is a program that the Conservation Fund supports to help people, to help communities create green spaces where there's little access to green space, which is perfect for the communities we're working with. A big part of this project, working with the Parks with Purpose, is that we were able to work with two people who worked with the program, Shannon Lee and Stacia Adams. They're incredibly helpful by helping us connect to a larger network of other cities, including Durham, North Carolina, and Baltimore, Maryland, who are also involved in the program and thinking about how do you create green space in a neighborhood in an equitable way, often when that neighborhood had not been treated equitably and had a pretty high distrust of government officials. And this started, we got the funding in 2018. We did some planning with the community in 2018, but I think we really hit the ground running with thinking about this project in 2019, when we were able to engage with Kofi Boone, who is a design professor at North Carolina State University, and his class. And for a whole semester, Dr. Boone and his class engaged with the community members in Biltmore Hills and Rochester Heights to think about what do they want in the green space that's easily accessible to them. So they spent that fall semester in 2019, engaging with the community around these ideas. And that engagement was also paired with the work of Jackie Turner, who is an engagement specialist in Raleigh. And she also helped us to engage with people about these ideas. She helped us to take what we learned from Dr. Boone's class and engage with more people in the neighborhood. So Dr. Boone had been running design charrettes and even done two or three day workshops with different community members with a real focus on children and then on families. And Jackie Turner was able to take that information when we learned from those events and spread it to the rest of the neighborhood and also help us ask a wider swath of citizens what they thought about these efforts. So at the end of 2019, we have a pretty good idea of what the community wanted in a park, and we contracted with design workshops to start the actual design of the green space. And our primary on that project was Emily McCoy and Corey Dodd. And Corey Dodd was a graduate of NC State that does some work in Southeast Raleigh during his undergraduate work. So it was really, it worked out really well that he was hired by Design Workshop and it kind of became the conduit between this design firm and the community. So of course, we all know what happened in 2019, and that's been referenced in other two presentations, that COVID-19 happened. And that really kind of changed how we were engaged with the community. Most of the work that we had done was all in person, door to door, over food, talking to people in a single space, which I think is a really good way to do community engagement. But that just wasn't possible with the outbreak of COVID-19, which kind of slowed down our engagement with the community. However, I just want to highlight here how, I guess, a corollary lesson is that if you're going to engage with communities, it's good to have funders who are flexible. And I really want to highlight the efforts here of the Conservation Fund and Stacia Adams and Shannon Lee. And when we had to make a stop, we weren't able to use our grant funding to do our traditional engagement efforts. They allowed us to provide food for the local, for St. Ambrose Episcopal Church was doing food drops during the period of time. They allowed us to do all of our mailings via letters, and they also allowed us to use our funds to buy masks for community members in the two neighborhoods. So I think it's important that if you engage with communities, that you meet the needs of the communities. And those needs changed during periods of time. And when COVID-19 happened, the needs of our community changed drastically. And we were fortunate that our funder allowed us to use our funds to help meet those needs. So in 2021, COVID kind of put a slowdown on things. We're really in this kind of idea of like, what can we do to help the community? In 2021, we engaged with the artists, and we were able to create an artist in our green, install art installation in our green space. And this is a temporary art installation, but we're hoping that it'll become permanent. And we were also finally able to come up with a final design for the green space. So really our next steps are to find more funding to implement all this design. We have right now enough to implement part of the green walkway, but we really want to implement all this design and continue to work with our community partners to address these issues. So briefly at the end, I just want to think about some lessons learned. If you notice throughout the whole presentation, I've been putting up the year each when all these activities happened. One of the biggest lessons that I've learned is that these processes take a lot of time. So we have been working with this community since 2014. And that means there's a lot of night meetings, going in odd hours, talking to people on the phone a lot, if you're not comfortable with that. And just, it takes time. So I think engaging with communities around risky issues and really thinking about that next step past risk communication, it just takes a lot of time. And I think in one of the earlier presentations, it was stated that grant cycles really don't line up with that time, and that's true. So you have to find ways that you can engage that are not tied to the normal grant cycles that we operate in as academics. The next lesson is that it takes a lot of people. So the effort that I talked about is just in two neighborhoods. It's not a very, they're not very big neighborhoods, but still it took a lot of hands and a lot of people to help out. And it's important that you engage with a lot of people because it takes a lot of work. So it's good to have a lot of hands helping out. And then the final lesson is really to be humble about the work. So like I said, we initially thought that we would think about a real focus on green infrastructure. Now is our initial thoughts of what we were doing in these neighborhoods. But fortunately, we were able to sit down and listen to what the community members were interested in. And they were interested in green infrastructure, but there are other things that they're interested in. And I think it's important that when you engage with communities, that you don't go inside, that you aren't too tied to your own ideas and how that engagement will happen, or what type of risk communication messages you want to talk about. Let's see. There we go. All right, I just want to say thank you. And here's some pictures of some other people who helped out at the university and across town. And I guess it takes a village. Yeah. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Louis, Dr. Rivers. I do want to just remind folks that if they have questions, they can put them in the Q&A. And anything we don't get to, we can save for the panel. But I'll start us off with a question that it's a personal one for me. So I teach risk communication. I train EPA staff on risk communication. And one of the things that I teach very many of the things that you sort of walk through, like the importance of building trust intentionally, the importance of really getting to know your audiences and taking the time up front to hear what they want before you tell them what you're going to do. And one of the things I sometimes hear is, we don't have time for that, how can I do it? Everything you're telling me to do, but how can I do it cheaper and faster, right? And my answer is, you can't. But I wonder if you have some thoughts on maybe better answers to that question that I often get. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, this may sound kind of snarky, but if you do it cheaper and faster, it's going to be more expensive in the long run. So it makes me think about this, these idea of boomerang effects, which I think Saul Hart from the University of Michigan identified maybe about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago. But sometimes if you have poorly designed risk communication strategies, you'll end up with behavior that's the exact opposite of what you want. So like, you can rush it if you want, but you'll pay for it later.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree completely. And it's often a part of my answer too, but I think it is, it's sometimes hard to get folks who haven't quite seen the light, if you'll forgive my religious metaphor, seen the light of the importance of this work. And I'm sure many of the folks on the call sort of face this struggle with the folks they work with to sort of, fight for resources for the importance of this work. But I really enjoyed hearing about your project. I wonder if you could talk a little bit as well, as we move into the questions. You talked about your focus group being all Black women and how that actually was a value. But I wonder if you feel for sure that you were representative of the views of the community, or if you think that was actually maybe not what everybody wanted, or if you had any thoughts on that or tried to deconstruct it at all.
No, I think that's super accurate. And I think it's true. They very much represent this one segment of the community. And if I'm to be honest with you, they were representing a segment of the community that was disappearing the quickest because they're older. They've been there the longest. The community was transitioning to like renters. It was gentrifying to some extent. But I think it was important to start with that group because I think they had a lot of leadership in the community and maybe understated leadership. But I think a lot of people in the community who may even been new to the community look to them to see what they're doing. And also I felt like they were keystones to the community. So this is a community that had gone through the kind of typical, there have been some amount of urban decline and people leaving the community for suburban neighborhoods, but these people have stayed through that whole period. I thought almost from an ethical standpoint, it was important to honor these people who are leaders and elders and seniors in the community. And we did reach these other parts of the community through the efforts of Kofi Boone and Jackie Turner, but we thought it was important to start with these people.
That makes sense. Let me see what I've got here. So when you think about, you mentioned I think this question comes out of when you mentioned that there was a historic issue with the neighborhood being divided. So when you think about the historical trust that has been eroded, what were some of the steps you took to intentionally rebuild that?
Well, I think a lot of that has to be given credit to the city. So we have city employees. I mentioned Kevin Boyer in the start. He was the head of stormwater. The city employees came to a lot of meetings. They took a lot of uncomfortable questions. They were okay with people being frustrated with them. And I have to give them, so I think a lot of that trust being rebuilt is due to like city employees coming, engaging and showing up and being okay with criticism. Mm-hmm. So that's really a credit to the people who work at the city of Raleigh.
Wonderful point. How did you go about identifying influencers? I know you mentioned a couple of folks that you worked with early on, but did you go beyond that? And how did you work with them to sort of align the messages of what you were trying to get across?
So when we initially reached out to, in some ways we were fortunate. So this group, Partners for Environmental Justice, was a very influential group. And they were already connected to the Walnut Creek Wetland Center. So they had connections between this group and the city government already. In fact, the Wetland Center is called the Dr. Norman and Betty Camp Education Center. So they were already fairly influential within the neighborhood, but they're also influential in town circles. So it was helpful to have them help us identify people in the neighborhood that we should also reach out to. And the same thing with Father Jamon. He helped us think about people in his congregation that we should reach out to, and also people in the neighborhood that would be important to reach out to. And like I said, a lot of the people in this neighborhood, it's really it's a bifurcated distribution in terms of age. You have a lot of, the elderly, then you have a lot of really young families. Mm-hmm. So it was really two different groups to kind of reach out to.
Yeah. Yeah, this next question maybe transitions us to the panel. I don't want to cut you short, Louis, but so I'll ask it for you. But I think if the other panelists could come on, it might be something that actually other people want. We want to hear from Al and Sharon on too, which is, you know, as you're working with partners, to what degree do you try to, make the message consistent? To what degree do you try to sort of say, here's what I want you to go out, here are your marching orders, versus just making sure you're on the same page with your partners and letting them just do what they want to do?
I'll be brief because I really want to hear how everyone else handles that. But I try to make sure we're on the same page. I'm kind of facing this issue in a current project right now in real time. I tell my university partners, we all have to have the same message and we have to be on the same page. So for university partners, I think this is a very strict, hierarchical, regimented way to work with communities. It's mm-hmm. good to have one voice, and that one, or if you have a different voice, it should sound the same as the other voice. But community partners, I don't think you can give them the same type of regimented order. So I just like to make sure we're on the same page. And hopefully through a process of talking and spending time together, you do start sharing the same message.
Al and Sharon, do you guys want to come back on and think about tackling that question too?
Yes, it's a good question. And it's not easy to answer because I think it's situational. But what we try to do is, sort of Hemingway-esque, we boil the message down to its essence and what needs to be there and what are the facts and what are the truths. And then to an extent, we have to trust our partners. It goes back to what Louis was saying, about working with your partners and trusting them to convey the message in a way that's appropriate for their community, that their community will be receptive to while remaining true to the essence of the message. And, it's a little dicey. It does involve, trust. I mean, one of the things that we try to do is we might come up with many different ways of disseminating the same essence, and in different formats for different audiences. We come together, we have a coalition of, and then we test it on the coalition, ask people what they think and what do they think will be the most successful ones. And then we usually adopt the ones that most people are not offended by and that, seem to embrace what it is we're trying to convey. But it's, you know, it's not a precise science, you know, I mean, at least from our perspective.
Yeah. I want to hear what Al says too, but if I can sometimes give my own thoughts on this, I'm actually dealing with an issue right now where we've got some, without giving too much away, we have some fundamental disagreements between EPA and some of our actual governmental partners, right? And how do you, at what point is that something that you actually let be seen by the public, right? I mean, I think Louis talked about this a little bit when he was talking about the university side, right? You got to get your ducks in the row behind closed doors, but sometimes that's impossible, right? So at what point do you sort of say, well, we're going to split and you're not going to be my messenger anymore. We're going to be our own messenger. But it's a tough thing from a public perspective to see non-government or to see governmental folks disagreeing or to see university folks disagreeing in front of them and can really erode trust. So it's not an easy answer. But Alan, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, no, Louis, when you were describing the Southeast Raleigh project, that's a community I've worked in. And one of my takeaways from that is that you talked about the residents. These are people who live in this community. I mean, they are flooded. It's their church, St. Ambrose, that's flooded. It's their community that's flooded, right? It's their community that has been torn into by the Beltline. And I respect that, you know, and I mean, with the Say Yes project, it was really about, you know, we had a campaign. Someone asked, when did you make the switch? Well, we switched when the community said we needed to switch, you know, because we were really listening to them on the ground. And we had not built in, we put a lot of money into mass media, and we realized it was really the social influencers that were on the ground that were really driving the project, which I think, as I mentioned, is the next wave of communication. It's going to be a little different. And so we're going to have to put into our budgets money for social media campaigns. And in the same way that others are financing disinformation through social media, we're going to have to influence some of that. That's going to be interesting. That's an interesting point. Like, will we skew public opinion as public health leaders and practitioners based on funding? Like, whoever gets the funding, whoever has the most dollars has the loudest voice, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough question. Just a reminder, keep putting questions in the Q&A so we can get to them, but I've got a couple left over from before. So, and there's one here that actually sort of plays off of what you just said, Alan, about influencers, right? So when you look, and I think this applies to all of you, but Alan can take it first. When you look at your results, do you have a sense of certain demographic groups that might be more affected by social media influencers than others? And do you have sort of a way to reach those that are outside that realm versus those that are inside?
I think that right now in COVID-19, we're challenged to think about how to reach younger populations, and particularly younger African-Americans around COVID-19. That's I'll just kind of take that particular demographic. I'm not sure that as public health leaders, we know how to penetrate that community with messaging. And it's so fast moving, as many of us are aware. In recent weeks, comments by celebrities to get vaccinated, to not get vaccinated. Man, those are the people that have 40 million followers, and our local public health department would be happy if they got 4,000 people. You know what I'm saying? I mean, in terms of scale, oh my God. You know, and it's interesting, I think, that we've seen in COVID-19, who are the leaders? Who are the influencers? For some people, it is Dr. Fauci. For others, he's the devil, right? But I do think that it is about trying to, you know, one of the things we're trying to do with even young African Americans around COVID-19 is to work with college students. We're trying to do that, young African-American college students, Latinx college students, and others around messaging. And that's why you saw in the Say Yes project, I am testing, right? So we kind of like took their celebrity, even local celebrity, and tried to turn that around and say, look, you know, do this because I'm doing this as part of that. But it's a challenge. I think COVID-19 has been, quite frankly, I would love to know what Sharon thinks. I think it's been a game changer, and we're going to write many, many books about health communication. What do you think, Sharon?
Alec, I couldn't agree more. And the other thing I think that you said that really resonated with me was the importance of taking your cues from and advice from your community. That's why they're your partners, because you trust them. And so we've done similar things where, and we work with a coalition, and we primarily serve an underserved, you know, in some cases unserved populations. We serve the, you know, the homeless. And so we convene our partners to talk about, you know, what are ways to reach people, especially related to vaccines and vaccine hesitancy. And you know, it's really been interesting because there's not any one group, any two groups necessarily that would recommend the same approach. Mm-hmm. With young people, they do, you know, they do advocate, you know, using social media and influencers, that kind of thing. But reaching the Asian community here has been primarily through both faith-based and social organizations. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, for the homeless, it's really, you know, word of mouth and using the organizations that are already working with them to spread the word. So I wish I had an easy answer. I mean, I think that it always comes down to context and knowing who, you know, and I mean, pardon me taking your turn, you know, the term, but knowing who the influencers are, and I don't mean social influencers, but knowing who those people are in your community that are capable of conveying the message. And, you know, that just depends on those partnerships that you have to have. And what I see here from both Al and from Louie is being embedded in those communities and understanding what they're facing. You know, I mean, it really is critical.
That sort of circles us back to the fundamental challenge that I brought up with Louie before too, right? Where it's, yes, you've got to do that pre-work. Yes, you've got to be in the communities, but how do you do that when everybody's resources for this kind of work, they're not big enough? Whether or not they're shrinking, I don't know right now, but it certainly isn't big enough.
Well, one thing that we've done, and we did this really as a life-saving measure, because you're right, you know, dollars are shrinking for everybody, including our partners. And so we formed this coalition. It's the Research Education and Community Health Coalition. We have about 40 organizations, nonprofits that belong to it. And it's 23 centers, institutes, and departments. And then there's other, you know, other universities from here too. But we get together once a month, and it started out, we share information, we share resources, we form work groups, because everybody comes to the table with, you know, with their asks and their offers, you know, that they, who they are, what are they doing, and then how can we work together to where they can maintain their goals and objectives without, I mean, not having to sacrifice that or have mission creep, but where we can support one another. And it's been surprisingly successful because we're not duplicating each other's work, and we're not cannibalizing each other by trying to run after the same dollars. So, I mean, it's a small, relatively local initiative, but what we try to do is support one another. And that's one way to do it. I'd be interested to hear how other people do that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, because I like real world examples, within minutes of the death of General Powell, public health leaders were on the alert to try to take that message and handle that message, because that message could get spun in so many different ways, right? So you think about like that. And so I think today, like, what's different in between 1918 and our first the big pandemic, and now, it's just access to information. We live in an information age, for good or bad. I grew up with three channels, ABC, NBC, and CBS, and that was it, right? Now you've got, you know, 1,000 channels, you've got international channels coming into your home, you have social, you can turn on any device and get information and news. The spin has to be, you know, people are spinning news both ways so quickly. It's such a challenge.
Yeah, and it's that information, but it's also the speed with, like, the shifting tide. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard for science to keep up, right? Mm-hmm. It tends to be a more plodding endeavor. I want to.
There's a lot of
go ahead, Louis. I do want to get a couple of questions in the chat.
There's a lot of information, but what we have found is that there is a lack of local information. It's hard for like hyper-local information to break through on this social media. So like there's a ton of like national information and there's a lot of social information, but like hyper-local information is really hard to get out through social media. It's hard to get that through. So that's another challenge.
Well, and that actually sort of ties a little bit to one of the threads that was going on in one of the earlier conversations was this question of privacy and stigma and sort of local trust. And I think it kind of cuts through all of your presentations in slightly different ways. But I wonder if you guys have thoughts on that. You know, I mean, I've heard anecdotally, for example, on COVID-19 that, you know, one of the leading indicators on vaccine success is how easily you can get a vaccine privately in places where perhaps it doesn't look good to your neighbors if you're the one who comes out and gets the vaccine. And I just wonder if you guys experienced any sort of level of that where like sort of providing the ability to do something privately or providing the ability to sort of really sort of like scratch the surface on the relationship help sort of erode some of that distrust and stigma.
I'm from Texas and people tend to just say what they think. They do what they do. But I take your point, especially about the stigma. Stigma is, you know, it's a big issue in a lot of our communities and related to COVID-19. And one of the messages that we've been trying to convey is to destigmatize testing and getting the vaccine and advocating for free choice, because what we found is that, you know, it's one thing to choose not to get a vaccine. It's another thing to actively encourage others not to get it. And, you know, with misinformation or disinformation or peer pressure, you know, so that's one of the things that we try to encourage is for, especially for our young people, think for yourself and give them the tools that they need to make effective decisions. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great answer. And I'm going to keep moving because we only got 2 minutes left and I got one or two more questions I want to get through. I think this one is for Louis. It says, I appreciated your discussion on how to manage tensions between academic researchers, government, and community groups. Can you elaborate on any strategies to solve those issues and share any experiences that might be relevant?
I think a big part of it is time. We were not funded for the first part of this project. So that first year when we were meeting with the people in the city, the academics were meeting with people in the city, we weren't funded, or when we were meeting with community leaders, but so it wasn't that pressure of a grant. So we were having like monthly lunch meetings. I think through that process of meeting, we started to have norms form amongst the group. I think that was really helpful. We didn't realize what we were doing, but I think that was helpful when we started to engage with members of the community. So it didn't feel like we were just running off at different points and kind of conflicting with each other. And I've seen the tension between government officials and scientists quite often after that project, especially in terms of data access and how to use share data and so forth. But I think the fact that we had that year of just kind of talking with each other informally, it really helped us when the work actually started.
Great information. I think we are about time to wrap, but I want to give you each one final word. So if there's one takeaway you want to share with the audience today, can you boil it down for us real quick? I'll let you go. I'll let you volunteer to go, so I won't call on you before you're ready. I should have warned you I was going to do this.
Communities do want to be
engaged. I'll just say active listening.
Yeah, Louis, go ahead. Please, Louis.
No, I just listen. I think listen is important and active listening. Like, I think that's the most important thing.
Intentionality of engagement.
For me, it all boils down to relationships and trust, you know, building that as much as you can, because when you have that, the communication is so much easier.
And takeaway would be to do that before the pandemic, to do that before the disaster. I would just kind of say, you know,
100%.
Yeah, build relationships when you don't necessarily need them, but keep them.
Yeah. So I love all of those bits of advice. I think they're wonderful. So it's active listening, intentional engagement, and building trust intentionally and ahead of time. Those things are wonderful advice. They're, of course, all hard to do, but I think you guys have illustrated the value of doing some of that work. We just want to thank you all again for being here. And I'm going to say a few things about what comes next as we conclude. That's the end of the Q&A and the end of this wonderful panel. Before we finally wrap up, I want to take a look back at the seminar homepage. The website will be active again from today, and it contains a lot of important resources, such as links from our presentation materials. And it will also include even more information about some of the links that they've shared and some of the links that came up during the discussion. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. Again, we really do use that information, so it's not a waste. If you have thoughts and want to offer feedback, we will use it to do better in the future. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected so that you don't miss any of our future webinars. For more information from EPA's Clue-In webinars, I'm going to assume that's how it is because it seems like it should be that way, please refer to the clue-in.org website. You can also subscribe to our free monthly e-newsletter there, which is called Tech Direct. And I should say, I mean, it's on the page, but it's Clue-In without the E. So if you don't want to spell it wrong. So we encourage you to visit the SRP Risk e-learning webpage to subscribe to our listserv so you can get information on our upcoming sessions. And we also have a Twitter account at SRP. I would like to encourage everyone to join us again on Friday, October 22nd as well for the final session of this series, the fourth and final, which will feature work by SRP-funded researchers who are translating research into communication tools and tailoring them for specific community needs. These specialized tools work to successfully communicate health risk and increase environmental health literacy. If you'd like to join the webinar, registration is filling up fast, so we encourage you to register now. If you can't attend, we will, of course, make the archives available after the event, so you can come back to the same page and find that information after the webinar. And with that, it's time to conclude today's webinars. If you submitted online questions and we did not have time to get to them, I know there were a handful that we didn't quite address directly. We will be passing those on to the presenters who can follow up with you directly. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage with everything else that you need on Clue-In. We'd like to very much, again, sincerely thank, I'll give a round of applause even, for Dr. Croissant, Dr. Rivers, and Mr. Richmond.